It's the same talk, actually, but this is what all our GitHub project folders are named for this project, so I thought I'd just go for it, call it DMRG squared. Because that's the eventual goal of this, though I give it the more technical term, isometric tensor network. So this is work I've been doing with Frank Pullman, mainly. And basically what we're after is to find a numerical method that will generalize DMRG to two dimensions. Of course, many people are working on this. This is the idea of PEPs, or two-dimensional tensor networks. And what we think we've found is a variant of the current way that people do PEPs. So that if you want to do, I think I will just scratch there. Right, so it's a variant of the way people do PEPs now, where if you have a 1D matrix product state algorithm, for example, DMRG, DMRG works by sweeping back and forth through your spin chain and twiddling different parts of the wave function to lower the energy. What it basically lets you do is generalize any 1D algorithm into a 2D algorithm by almost literally writing your code as a nested for loop, where here, where you would twiddle with a given site to reduce the energy, you instead call 1D DMRG and it will optimize a column. And then you move on to the next one and optimize this column. And so you can sweep back and forth like this in just a nested version of the 1D algorithms, hence DMRG squared. To summarize what the advance was, it was basically a change in notation. So PEPs, or 2D tensor networks, people usually draw these stick figures like this. All I'm going to do is actually add all these arrows here. So it's a massive leap in notation. I'll argue that adding these arrows, which really means that we're going to impose certain isometry conditions on the tensors, makes all the calculations much faster. I also found that it makes talk preparation vastly, vastly slower, because it takes a lot of time to add these arrows. So I slept a lot less than I slept much less than I intended to. So first, let me summarize the success of DMRG. We can just look at Steve White's top publications here. He came up with this algorithm in 1992. We've since been understanding it in a very interesting way in terms of the structure of entanglement in quantum ground states. So it's an algorithm ultimately for finding the ground state of a Hamiltonian. We can now actually mathematically prove that if the Hamiltonian has a gap, the time to find that ground state will scale as a polynomial with a system size. And if it's a gap phase, well, it'll be a polynomial in system size even if there's not a gap. But if it's a gap phase, effectively, the algorithm will be linear in system size.
So that's a rigorous statement?
The rigorous statement is that it's a polynomial in system size if there's a gap. So this is a result by like Umesh Vazirani and Thomas Vidic. In practice, if it's gapped, you find that it converges in a time just linear in L. You'd never expect better than that because you have to visit everywhere. So in practice, it's linear in L for a gap system. I'll get back to actually some of what these mathematical results actually are. That's also the sense in which it's unbiased, and that like a variant of DMRG that also works with 1D tensor networks just provably works if the phase is gapped. You can routinely get, say, like 12-digit accuracy for various observables, depending on how much entanglement is in the problem, and work at perimeter and elsewhere is generalize this to time-dependent problems, finite temperature, critical states, etc. So if we get all of these same things to work in 2D, that would be fantastic. So what's the underlying engine that gets DMRG to work so well? Well, ultimately, it's a variational method. And the variational ansatz, or space, is either called one-dimensional tensor networks or matrix product states. This goes back to here they called them finitely correlated states and work at FANUS. So the way it works is if you want to write down a wave function on a set of spins, the Hilbert space of the spins is spanned by these product states here, where you can imagine n sub I is, say, up or down is the state of the spin on site I. So we need to generate a huge number of amplitudes for all the different possible spin configurations. And the way we get it is for each site, we have a rank 3 tensor. It has 3 indices here. And then you contract together these so-called ancilla ones and leave the physical ones dangling. That gives you the amplitude. So the picture we do for this, and to be honest, if you haven't seen these pictures before, the rest of the talk is going to be extremely mysterious. is for a rank 3 tensor, you draw it as a dot with 3 legs coming out, and then we use this Penrose graphical notation for contraction, which is that if you want to sum over an index, then you just contract the leg. So these dangling legs here are the leftover uncontracted indices. A key parameter which is going to show up is the size of the tensors. We'll call it the bond dimension. I'll use the symbol D here. As you increase D, the complexity of the algorithms is going to go as some polynomial with D, which is going to be important. But your variational power increases, so you should get better energies. How do you get the energy? Well, all you're using is the variational theorem, which is the size depend on T. On the Bs, you choose the Bs so to minimize the energy, and that will give you a good approximation of the ground state. And DMRG is just an iterative way of tensor by tensor going left and right and reducing the energy. OK, so 2D tensor network states, we hope eventually, will work really, really well. Now it's a little bit up in the air, though there's been a lot of interesting progress recently. Serac and Verstrata called these projected entangled pair states, or PEPs, which I'll also call them. I was looking back in the history of when they showed up. So certainly Nishino proposed these states in 2001. And I learned from Norbit that there's actually a thesis here, unpublished in 1996, which proposes them. So they go quite a ways back. But what we understand of PEPs is far less than in 1D. First, there's theoretical questions, like what phases can be approximated by a PEPs? We know the phase has to have an aerial offer entanglement, but that's certainly not a sufficient condition. Another more quantitative thing would be like, how does the error in the fidelity to represent a state scale with the dimension of the tensors you use here? And then there's practical questions, just how do you compute observables and optimize the tensors efficiently? So I'm actually going to first focus on the practical questions. So why are tensor network calculations hard to do in 2D? Well, the typical thing you need to do is just compute, for instance, fix all the values of your tensors, and let's just compute the expected value of the energy. Well, let's even be less ambitious than that. Let's just try and get the denominator here right. We just need to compute the norm of the wave function. So if you look what it looks like, we have one copy of the tensor network for the ket, one copy for the bra, and then we contract all these indices together, and we have to sum them. So you do the physical index first. That's easy. But now it collapses down into a 2D grid of indices in the so-called ancilla space here. Formally, it kind of looks like the path integral or partition function of a 2D StatMech model now. But that, of course, has exponentially terms in it. So you can't just like exactly do the sum. So we need some way to approximate even the norm of the state. Now, what this suggests is, well, if this looks like a 2D StatMech model, a 2D StatMech model is kind of like a 1D quantum model, and DMRG can solve 1D quantum models. So is there going to be some sort of dimensional reduction we can do to, say, approximately compute this expectation value, or sorry, the norm? And this is the basic idea that people have been using thus far. So it's called the boundary matrix product state method. I first learned about it from Frank Verstrata and Ignacio Serac. So we want to do this giant contraction. The way we're going to do it is start on the left and then move rightwards. So for example, suppose all the tensors here we had contracted into this massive object. It has a bunch of dangling legs, so it's a very high rank tensor, and I'll just call it E2. So this to store itself would be like storing a 1D quantum wave function. It's exponentially large. But perhaps we can approximate this thing, since it looks like a 1D chain, using a matrix product state. So you break this thing up into a product of tensors. I'll call it E here along the line. Now, when you do that, you introduce a new approximation, which is the finite bond dimension of this boundary MPS. And a priori, we have no idea what the relationship is between the eta you'd need here and what the bond dimension of the PEPs is. OK, so suppose I just have it for contracting the first two. How do I get the, people also call this the environment, either the environment or boundary MPS for the first three columns? Well, you just need to look at this equation. It's kind of like time evolving a state. If you have here the boundary for the first two, we need to tack on one more column here. People call this the transfer operator. This is like taking matrix product state and multiplying it by an operator, like time evolution. And then you do the standard algorithm for MPS compression to bring it back into matrix product state form. And then you could just repeat this and continue. And of course, you need to do it from the left to get the left environment, and the right to get the right environment, and they meet in the middle. And since both are matrix product states, it now looks like the contraction of two matrix product states. But once you've done this dimensional reduction, everything's easy because we have efficient algorithms to do anything you want with a matrix product state. So this can now be done efficiently. And this approximation sign will become exact as long as the boundary MPS you use large enough bond dimensions when you approximate it. So there's been progress actually, for example, last year in figuring out more efficient ways to do this. An important thing is how does the time scale with the parameters here? You have this dimension of the PEPs, like the tensors here, and then you have the dimension of this boundary thing, eta, and it's some somewhat horrendous polynomial of this form here. So much more expensive than DMRG. And empirically, it's found that this boundary tensor, this boundary MPS, you need a bond dimension way larger than D, actually. So for example, when people do this for the 2D antiferromagnetic Heisenberg model, if the PEPs is bond dimension 5, this eta thing has to be 100. So this term becomes very expensive here. So this is the dominant cost of doing PEPs algorithm now, is just computing contractions like this. Okay, so what are we going to do which is different? The outline of this talk is, first I'm going to tell you about a restriction of the PEPs onsots, which basically gets rid of these environments. Then I'm going to discuss some theoretical calculations and speculation on what the variational power of this new onsots is. And then at the very end, some of you can sleep, I'm going to discuss the actual algorithms, at the center of which is something we call the Moses move, and a way to do TBD and DMRG that ends up having a cost which is much less than the current algorithms. Okay, so what are we going to exploit here? It's the fact that tensor networks have a gauge redundancy. And what I mean by that is, given the set of tensors T, that gets turned into a quantum state, but that's actually a many-to-one mapping. Different tensors can give you the same state. And there's an easy way to see that. Suppose you have a given PEPs, and then on this auxiliary bond, you introduce a resolution of the identity, so X inverse, and you take that tensor and absorb, you take this X and absorb it into the tensor there and this one there. So that's going to change these two neighboring tensors, but of course the state's the same. So there's a point of principle that shows this is a many-to-one mapping. And of course, there's more complicated gauge transformations you could do where you could act in an entangled way on two of these ancilla legs, take this two thing, glob it onto these two, and then split them again. And that's a more complicated change. So these single leg transformations aren't that complicated, because when you glob them on, it doesn't change the dimensions of the tensors themselves. But it is worth noting that the current boundary MPS methods, like the bumps, if you look at them, the actual result, like the eta you would need, would change if you do a gauge transformation like this. And no one is paying that much attention to whether there's like special choices you should make here to have it work better. It's already at the single leg level. There's a bit of an issue there. And if you do these multi-leg transformations like this, it will actually change the dimensions of the tensor. Generically, it would increase them, but in some cases, it could actually decrease them. So you might wonder, like, what if the algorithm gets stuck in a bad version of the PEPs, but you could do this gauge transformation and make it lower bond dimension? That could be possible. So it's natural to try and fix these redundancies by demanding that the tensor satisfy some other condition. And this is the general idea of a canonical form. Okay, so what condition do we want to enforce? Well, we hate these environments, the fact that you have to contract all these tensors using this complicated algorithm. So what if we could enforce a tensor, a condition on the tensors, such that whenever you do this contraction, you're guaranteed that the resulting environment here is literally just the identity. So it's just a delta function for each of the ancilla pairs. And I'm showing the condition from the left. We could also require it to be true from the right, from the top, and from the bottom. This will be a very special property of the tensors, like for this contraction to just give the identity. You won't be able to enforce it just by inserting one of those one-leg redundancies.
So you are always dealing with finite system size?
In what I'll show, yeah, but I mean, we could discuss afterwards. I don't think there's really an obstruction to doing it in the thermodynamic limit. Yeah. Okay, so if you could enforce this, you would never need to calculate any environments at all. They're just trivially the identity. And you'd remove this very expensive part of the PEPs algorithm. So actually, we do this in 1D all the time. So to explain it, because I don't want to write out indices of any tensors, I need to add a new graphical notation, which is that some of my tensors I want to be isometries. So if I have a matrix A with a row and a column, the isometry condition basically just says that if you do A dagger A, you get the identity. But if you do A dagger, you get a projector. So the way I think of this is A is a rectangular matrix where this incoming side, which I'll call the UV, is a really big Hilbert space. And the outgoing side is a small Hilbert space. So A can't be a unitary. But the infrared corresponds to an orthonormal subspace of the UV. Okay, so that's what these conditions here. So literally, it's just a rectangular matrix where all the columns were orthogonal. I like to think of it as you can think of flowing this way, where you're taking the big Hilbert space and just applying a projector and throwing out degrees of freedom. Or you can think of it the other way, that the infrared is embedded as a subspace of the UV. So the way I'm going to draw this, there's clearly a distinction between the UV side and the IR side. So I'll draw an arrow incoming on the UV and outgoing on the IR. And what these conditions mean graphically is if you take a tensor with these arrows and you contract it with its complex conjugate, and you contract the incoming arrow, then this condition tells you that you get the identity. It wouldn't work the other way. If you contract the outgoing arrow, you get some complicated projector. OK, so that's all we need to know. If you so this generalizes to higher rank tensors. Like, suppose I have a three-leg tensor with two incoming arrows and one outgoing. You can always reinterpret this as a matrix by just grouping the two incoming together. But what all we need to know diagrammatically is if you see a contraction like this, the tensor is contracted, all its incoming arrows are contracted, so it just trivially gives one. Same with the outgoing thing here. We contract the incoming, so it's an identity in the outgoing arrows here. OK, so once we have this, we're going to be able to do all the calculations we need graphically. So what's the idea of the canonical form in 1D? It's basically that all the tensors that form the matrix product state, rather than letting them be generic, you demand that they are isometries with this particular structure of ingoing and outgoing arrows. So on the left, it's an isometry from the physical and the ancilla back into the ancilla. From the right, it works the other way. And then these two different forms merge together at the middle here, where everything's incoming. The site where the two forms join, people call either the orthogonality center or the one-site wave function. And it turns out, actually, any matrix product state can be brought into this canonical form without increasing the bond dimension, just using some standard linear algebra. This is actually the sense in which the densely matrix renormalization group is a renormalization group. I think of it like this. This here in the UV is the huge Hilbert space of all the spins on the left. And what you're doing is, as you go through each of these tensors, you're taking a big Hilbert space, throwing part of it out, keeping the important states. And as you're flowing like this, by the end here, you're keeping only the important part of the Hilbert space here. And I think that's why I think of it as an origin. OK, so why is it useful? Let's go in the 1D case to compute the norm of the wave function. So you take the matrix product state in canonical form, a copy of it here. And just like as I was talking about in 2D, we're going to start on the left and start contracting inward. But let's look at the first contraction here. You took a state and contracted with a complex conjugate. All the incoming arrows are contracted. So just for free, this thing gets removed and replaced by the identity. Then we come to the second tensor. We've contracted over both incoming arrows. So for free, we can just remove it and replace it with the identity. Likewise from the left. So all this contraction of the A's and B's just tautologically goes away. And you're left at the very end only computing the lambda. So now it just looks like computing the norm of a zero-dimensional wave function on this site here. And the norm of the global many-body state is just the norm of zero-site wave function lambda. OK, so that's useful. So you just don't even need to know about those tensors to compute the norm. What if you need to compute an expectation value? So let's say I put an O here, and suppose I get lucky, and the expectation value I want to compute sits where my current orthogonality center is. Well, the same manipulation goes through, all the boundaries cancel here and here, and I'm left with this one-site wave function expectation value here. So it's cool. It tells you that lambda stores all the properties of expectation values at this site, irrespective of what the A's and B's are doing. So what's the generalization to 2D? I'm going to do a similar thing where each of the tensors in the network, I'm going to demand be an isometry from three of the legs to two of the legs. Why did I say three here? My notation's a little unclear. Each of these tensors is rank 5. There's 4 ancillas, or virtual, and then there's the 1 physical. I'm drawing the physical as kind of small, but implicitly there's always an incoming arrow coming from the physical. So that's the 3 to 2 here. So what it means, if you see this tensor and you contract with yourself with itself, and you contract all these incoming arrows here, you know it just tautologically gets 1. But there's 4 different directions I can do it, down this way, and down this way. And then they meet in this red thing, which is the analog of the orthogonality center, but now it itself is a one-dimensional matrix product state, like this. And then that one-dimensional matrix product state can itself be put in the 1D canonical form, and then it will have its own orthogonality center there. So we're going to have 2 bond dimensions we'll keep track of. 1 is the bond dimension of all these isometries here. And then eta, I'll allow it to have a different bond dimension inside the orthogonality center, though it's not really clear to me quite yet whether it needs to be different. Okay, so let's go back to the problem of computing the norm. You take the state and overlap it with itself. Now it's kind of fun. Let's start at the upper corner here. This is an isometry. It has only 1 incoming arrow and we've contracted over it, so you can just get rid of it and it disappears. Now you look at this tensor here. It has 2 incoming. We contract over its incoming arrows, it just disappears. This one disappears. Now that one will disappear. And you could continue doing this and all these tensors here, you know, you start from the bottom corner, this corner, this corner, and all the tensors just tautologically disappear and you're left with the middle lambda one. But then that's computing the norm of 1D matrix product state, which can be computed efficiently. So it's like a automatic dimensional reduction where the 2D reduces to 1D and then the 1D to 0D. So in the language of environments, we've actually accomplished what we set after. Suppose I want to contract the environment for the first column here. Well, you just use this the same characteristic that you can start at this corner, this goes away, and you get the identity on this. And that chains through like this and chains through from the bottom, and just tautologically the environment is trivial. And then when you go to compute the second environment for the first 2 columns, you already know the input from the left, and you can use the same property here, and you'll find inductively that E2 is trivial, et cetera. So all the environments now become the identity until you hit the orthogonality center. And then from the left, you can't go beyond that because the direction of the arrows switch.
So
yeah.
If you're actually to implement this, the A and B tensors, if you will, are just like variational parameters. Is it easy to impose that they're isometries somehow in a variational method? Like to enforce that they have to be isometries?
Yeah, it ends up not being that hard. So it's exactly as you said, you'll have like an A, a B, a C, and a D tensor, and you're going to minimize over them, but you're going to enforce that they remain isometries. Yeah, I'll discuss that. So it turns out you can do it, and it's not more expensive, basically. Now, what's not clear is whether this has the same variational power as general PEPs, and I'll get into that.
And A, B, C, D are, in principle, completely independent?
It depends what symmetries you have, but if you just took a kind of spatially dependent Hamiltonian, there'd be no relation between them.
Okay.
Now, this property that I took a region here, and when I contract the environment, I just trivially get the 1, actually holds for more general regions. The rule is the following. If you draw a region and its boundary is space-like, and by space-like, I mean that it only has outgoing arrows, then you're guaranteed that if you do the double contraction in this region, you get the identity. Another way of saying what it is if you look at all this, you can think of it as a function from the physical degrees of freedom into the ancilla degrees of freedom. And that function is just a big isometry. So it's just a change of basis.
Just one question.
Yeah.
It's like when you're contracting, in the previous slide, you contracted to the vertical column.
Yeah.
You can also contract to the horizontal column as well, right?
Yeah.
Why can't you reduce it down to just like single site.
Yeah, if in this, it doesn't show up super well, but I've colored this red. I put the arrows inside the red. In that case, I mean, magically, for some reason, I forgot to write the arrows here. If we'd write the arrows here as well, it's clear that, like you said, tautologically, it would reduce down to the red thing for free as well. Yeah. So this lambda thing, you could view it either, like, you could either look at the row or look at the column, either way. Lambda really is the wave function, like in the following sense. Each of these quadrants here, all these tensors just implement an orthogonal change of basis from the physical degrees of freedom into the Ancilla degrees of freedom. So if you view this as a wave function with these degrees of freedom, those degrees of freedom are just a rewriting of the degrees of freedom in that quadrant. So in particular, like, suppose you want to know the entanglement between this region and this region, then you can just throw away these tensors and throw away these tensors and look at this 1D state and then compute the entanglement between its left leg and its right legs. So like all the entanglement properties between the four quadrants are encoded in lambda. Okay, so how would you compute a two-point function? Let's say you get lucky and I want to compute a two-point function where my four quadrants fit together in this way and my lambda tensor is this red thing. Suppose my two points are on the lambda, then I get really lucky because when I do the double line, when I do the double contraction, by the isometry condition, this whole quadrant just disappears tautologically, this whole quadrant, et cetera. So all the quadrants disappear tautologically and then you're left with only this red line to contract. But this is just like calculating the expectation value of, it's like two-point function of the 1D matrix product state, but that's efficient to do. So you just throw it into the 1D matrix product state algorithm at this point, and you compute it cheaply. So in particular, this two-point function takes time d squared eta cubed, whereas if you had to do boundary environments, it's at least d cubed eta to the fourth or fifth, I think.
Sorry, why did the little legs on the left and right disappear?
Because which legs? This thing here?
Up from there, and then to the right, for instance, from there.
This one?
Yeah, why did that? Because you have different tensors on the top and bottom that aren't, that don't...
Sorry, when you say top and bottom, do you mean bra and ket or north and south?
I mean north and south, above and below that.
Uh-huh. These are different than these. Yeah.
Yeah, so...
Well...
So that doesn't contract away automatically.
Let me look at this region right here. Let me just go back to a picture that has more arrows. So it's basically like contracting this thing. But what would happen is you start at this corner and this guy goes away for free and this guy goes away for free. And you'll have the incoming identity here. When you start here, all of these go away for free. And then you'll see this one now has that leg contracted and that leg contracted. So then it goes away for free and then it collapses in that way. Yeah.
Excuse me?
Yeah.
But when you have the orthogonality center,
yeah,
you have that you could simplify around me. But this picture looks different, right?
Yeah, this is a little more different. I took this leg and, instead of having it there, I moved it over here. There's some rules about, like, to get it to work, you'll find you can never have it bend like this because... Basically, there's a kind of a causal structure to it. There can never be loops of arrows. And you'd get in trouble if you ever bent it like this, but it's okay to put it like this. But now what you could ask is how the heck, if I started there, did I move it over there? Which I haven't addressed yet, but that's I'll get to later. So there's one corollary of this, actually, is that it follows that these isometric tensor networks have exponentially decaying correlation functions. Because if you take any two-point function like this, you tautologically map it to a 1D matrix product state correlation function. And now if you ask what's the asymptotic decay if you move this O2 away, it's known that matrix product states have exponentially decaying correlations. Now the reason that's interesting is that a generic tensor network, or is it like a generic PEPS, actually can have algebraic correlations. Like there's this famous example of it called the Ising PEPS. So this isometric tensor network is less powerful in that sense than the full tensor network on SOTS. But I should point out, and this will be interesting, we'll hear about this in Andrea Lauckley's talk, like this example of algebraic correlations that people cooked up is not at all a 2D CFT. It's like a Lifshitz phase transition.
But people, 2D actually means 3D.
Yeah. 2 plus 1D.
It's actually 1 plus 1 CFT. I mean,
well, I mean, as a quantum state, this icing PEPS is like a Z equals 2, people call it conformal quantum critical point.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
It has correlation functions of the 1 plus 1D Ising model. Anyways, it's not Lorentz invariant or anything. So it looks like what we'll learn from Andrea's talk is that if you have a Lorentz invariant CFT and try and represent it as a PEPS, it doesn't seem that the PEPS can exactly represent it. So it's not really clear that we lose that much by throwing out these kind of reverse states and working with the isometric tensor network. Interesting question, though. Okay. But this raises the question, suppose I got lucky that my two insertions were on the red line. What if my two insertions were away from it? So what would happen is, let's look at it by analogy to 1D. We did the contraction in for free to the left. But then when you have this impurity here, you can no longer do the isometry condition to just replace this thing with the identity. So the same thing will happen in 2D. All these tensors will collapse for free until you hit the point. And then in the future light cone of that point, you'll spoil the isometry condition here, and it will spoil it for its neighbors, et cetera. And you'll be left with this square to contract. And likewise, you'll be left with this square to contract. So you would have reduced it to this region here. Yeah, so one way you could go about it is you keep it like this, and then you just start evaluating what this network is by starting at this point and then moving it forward. It's exactly like taking an operator and evolving it under the Heisenberg equation, where time is going this way, so it will like grow in some way. But luckily, it's actually a dissipative Heisenberg evolution, because formally, if you look at what this kind of evolution is, it's not unitary evolution, it's actually a quantum channel. So literally, this will behave like an operator growing under the influence of a dissipative quantum channel. So it'll probably kind of get complicated at first, get big, and then it will like decay. So you might be able to actually do it that way, and that's something we're working on now. But another thing you might hope to do is, suppose you just had some algorithm where you could move this red string over conveniently. Then you just move the red string over to the insertion you want, and then use what I said before. So this is the key algorithm that we're going to need, and we call it the Moses move for reasons I will discuss when I get there.
Right.
Yeah.
Sorry, I'm puzzled by the drawing. That this red dot that you keep having there.
This one.
Is that for reference?
It's not that important. It's that. The red lines as a whole, you could think of, like, let's say you look at this middle red line.
Yeah.
It has all incoming arrows, so you can think of it as a matrix product state for the system. That 1D matrix product state itself has an orthogonality center. But it that, which is what I denoted by this red dot.
Okay.
But because it's in 1D, and in 1D we can just losslessly move the orthogonality center around, it doesn't matter too much where it is. So the red dot, you can always move for free anywhere without any approximations or anything. Like, you think of it as follows. So you have this red dot here, and if you just focus on this column, it looks like a 1D matrix product state with the orthogonality center here. But we know there's a standard algorithm to move a 1D matrix product state like lambda over to there, and you'd flip this arrow.
So
and you can do that.
So when you do like directional optimization, or just finding a ground state, is it like you're just moving this red dot like sequentially?
Yeah, that's what will be like. The red dot's gonna move like this. That's skipping ahead. Okay, so now that I've said what the ansatz is, I want to discuss theoretically a little bit about the variational power of the ice, this ansatz. So we know from this reasoning about, for instance, this gapless icing PEPS that the isometric tensor networks are a subset of all PEPs, at least if we strictly keep just all bond dimensions finite and ask about exact equality rather than like approximation, it's a subset. So we need to know whether it's a useful subset or whether there's some like, if it had some perverse property like two-point functions in the shape of like, where the 2 points are behind each other have to be zero or something stupid like that, then it would be no good. But we haven't found any restrictions like that. But anyway, we want to know what phases have an ISO tensor network representation, and even more ambitious, what entanglement properties determine the rate at which the representation would converge with bond dimension. So one thing I'm 94% sure we've proven, the Tomo pointed out a small issue to me yesterday, but I'm pretty sure it's still true. So is that all string net states can be exactly put in the isometric tensor network form. Now, many of you know that we believe that any gap 2D phase of matter whose edge can be gapped has a string net representative. Okay, so gapped phase with gappable edges are string nets. What do I mean by gappable edge? Well, like if you have integer quantum Hall, it has a chiral central charge and you can't gap out the edge. So anything with a chiral edge state is not gappable and doesn't have a string net representation. But I'm familiar from work with Mike Levin and others that there's even certain non-chiral phases which have exotic anion content where you can't gap out the edge, and those also don't have string net representatives. So sometimes I'll say chiral versus non-chiral, but really I mean gappable edge versus non-gappable edge. And it's a property of the topological order. Anyway, so the string net states are all isometric tensor network states. In particular, any product state is a type of string net state. The other thing we can prove is that if you have a wave function which is an isometric tensor network, and then you apply a finite depth unitary circuit to it, then you can trivially bound, you can show that U phi is still an isometric tensor network state with a bond dimension that grows in some bounded way. So the picture we then have, roughly speaking, if you put one and two together, is that all gap phases with gappable edges, see, I went from states to phases because of two, have an isometric tensor network form. Because the picture is the string net is like the special point here, this is the phase diagram from Levin and Wen. This provably is an isometric tensor network, and you can deform a little bit away from it by applying a finite depth circuit, and we know the bond dimension grows, but grows boundedly. So you could then fill out all these regions here. And then there's these mysterious things like fractional quantum Hall states, which don't have gappable edges, which we can't say anything about right now. However, you should note this says nothing about the, really the important question is how the error to approximate states behaves, and we can't say anything about that yet. I will very quickly go through the proof. I mean, basically, we know data from QFT, Levin, and Wen taught us how to write down wave functions, and then later work by Giffrey and others showed that all these string net states have tensor network representations where the entries of the tensors are literally like the F symbols and quantum dimensions, appropriate combinations of the topological data. So that's great. We can go from TQFT to a tensor network. But if you write down this tensor network and look at the tensors, they're not isometries, at least not obviously. So what we've basically been working on is you can use this gauge redundancy I've talked about to massage the tensors. And we show that if you use this gauge redundancy to be certain powers of quantum dimensions and like projectors on diffusion channels, and you combine that with the fact that in a TQFT, the F matrices are unitary, that unitary ends up exactly implying, combined with some gauge transformations, the desired isometry properties. So tensor by tensor, you can bring the string net state by these gauge transformations into an isometric form where the arrow structure looks like this. And then you can, as I was showing before, you can have a boundary between two different ways of signing the arrows and they meet at a tensor lambda, which is like the wave function, and you can show that the thing that glues them together is actually just a tensor product of quantum dimensions. And that produces known properties of the entanglement spectrum and so on. Okay. I'll also briefly talk about why under a unitary circuit, it's still an isometric tensor network. So this is a paper of Giffrey's here. We're applying some unitary circuit like this. We want to bound how much the bond dimension grows. It's sufficient just to look at one layer where the width of them is M. And we can basically show through a set of moves where you like coarse grain by M, you apply the unitary on one site. Because these are unitaries, if it's on a single site, it just trivially preserves the isometric condition. And then a fine-graining move where you split it back up. Both here and here, the bond dimensions grow. So you get a very stupid bound that if you apply this, the bond dimension goes from D to this kind of terrible thing. But still, as long as it's a finite depth circuit, this gives a very crude bound showing that the bond dimension stays finite. OK, so here's the question I'm trying to think about now, but I'm not really sophisticated enough to think about it, so I'd appreciate if you guys would help, would be, this is really the question we want to know, is if psi is a target state and psi d is the best approximation we can make using a rank d isometric tensor network state, what are the entanglement properties of psi which would be sufficient to bound the error in approximating psi with that given bond dimension? So that's what we really want to know. There's a beautiful result of Sirach and Verstrata, which actually worked this out in one dimension. So what they proved is the following. Suppose you have a 1D state, and when you cut it into the left and right, suppose the maximal nth Renyi entropy you can get is Sn. So you pick an n, and then you find the maximal nth Renyi entropy for all cuts. Then the error per unit length in a matrix product state approximation is bounded in this way here. The Sn shows as a prefactor here. So as you'd expect, a lot of entanglement causes this to blow up and therefore bigger error. But still, you can show that this error decreases a polynomial with bond dimension d. It's important, actually, that the Renyi index you use here is n less than 1. So this is the kind of result I want. Like, it's an entanglement property which then proves convergence properties. And this is one of the things which establishes the linear L difficulty of area law phases in 1D. It also tells you that, like, if you have a CFT, and the CFT Sn grows, but it's not that big, and it just actually leads to a polynomial decrease in the accuracy. So that's also a useful thing to know. So 2D, we know that area laws definitely aren't enough. There's a result by Jens Eisert showing that area law states don't even have to be ground states, let alone PEPs. So that leads to an interesting open question. We have this kind of hierarchy of area law states from gapped non-chiral edges, gapped with chiral edges, gapless CFTs, ground states, area laws. What exactly, all of these have an area law, but what is like the finer grain type of entanglement distinction between them, such that maybe some are proximal by these isometric tensor networks and some aren't? Of course, doing this for PEPs is extremely difficult. I'm a little more hopeful with the isometric tensor networks. Because everything's an isometry, lots of quantum information ideas are much easier to work with because they're basically just unitary transformations and they just preserve a lot of properties. Like the transform matrices or quantum channels and so on. Okay. So for the final 15 minutes, I will talk about the algorithms. So the key part in getting all this to work is being able to move over this orthogonality center, the lambda thing. So doing this in 1D canonical form is trivial. So what I mean by move over the orthogonality center is suppose you start out with it like this, with the orthogonality center on site 4, and you want to move it over to site 5. Well, when you do this, you can focus just on the two sites that are involved here, 4, 5, and ignore all the other tensors. So let's focus on those two. And then it's a simple equation you have to solve, which is you contract these two together, these two tensors here. And then you view it as a matrix from these two indices to these two indices. And then you just do an orthogonal decomposition like QR to rewrite this matrix as a product of an orthogonal transformation or unitary and upper right triangular matrix. And then you just call this thing your new A and you call this thing your new lambda prime. Right? Because this was an orthogonal decomposition, trivially Q and therefore A has this arrow structure that it's an isometry from these two to that. Okay, so this is like completely standard linear algebra. And it didn't actually matter what orthogonal trans decomposition I did. I discussed QR. You could also do SVD, where you take this matrix and write it as USV, the singular value decomposition, and instead call A the U thing. It doesn't matter. So you could actually use this unitary ambiguity here to enforce various properties of the lambda prime you get out. Now, one thing that's clear from the properties of this linear algebra is that as you sweep through and move the orthogonality center, the dimension of the tensors doesn't change. So if it started out a rank D MPS and you move it through, it will stay a rank D MPS. Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. I'll just do this one. So basically what the Moses move is a way to solve that equation where you take two columns of the PEPs, you just group it into a wave function, and then you rewrite it, you split it again into a product of two columns where you flip the arrows around. So previously the arrow here went to the left, and afterwards the arrow here goes to the right. Okay. So if you can do that, if you can take this two-sided wave function and write it as a product of a matrix product isometry and another thing here, that's the equivalent of being able to move the orthogonality center over. And the way we choose this A is so that it minimizes the entanglement of the new lambda tensor. And the caveat is when you do this generically, the bond dimension will actually increase bond dimension here. So if you want to keep all your bond dimensions finite, this is actually an approximation. I'll just kind of quickly go through it. The reason Roger called it Moses move is the way we do it is we basically start out doing some move on the bottom where you take a tensor and you split it into a triangle. And then once you've split it, you pull this move up through the thing. You like unzip it tensor by tensor into something like that. I probably won't get into it because I don't have much time, but it's a very interesting problem in many body entanglement, I think, figuring out how to do this unzipping. I'll just skip that. But the net cost is just A to cube D cubed, which is less than any of the boundary MPS algorithms. So it's cheaper to do the Moses move than compute boundary environments. I think I will also skip this test. Basically, we test that if you are given a wave function, can you use the Moses move to iteratively put it in the isometric form? And the answer appears to be yes. I'm going to skip that to get to how we do TBD. So the idea for TBD squared is the following. Regular TBD due to Giffrey is if you have a state represented as a matrix product state and you want to apply time evolution to it, either real or imaginary, you first trotterize the time evolution into a set of gates, and then graphically you need to evaluate this thing. You have matrix product state at the initial time at the top, and then gate by gate, you're applying them like this. And each time you apply a gate, you generally leave the matrix product state on slots, so you do matrix product state compression to bring it back to MPS form. What does that compression look like? Well, suppose you apply a gate here. What we're going to make sure is that at each step, the orthogonality center is like right here. You apply the gate to thicken it, and then you do SVD to bring it back like this. And that also moves the orthogonality center over by one so that you're ready to apply the next gate. So as your trotter gate sweep left and right at the same time, your orthogonality center is sweeping left and right with it, which is why you can always just focus on local properties and nevertheless get a globally optimal truncation. So how do we do this in 2D? First, the trotterization. I'm going to assume it's a nearest neighbor interaction. You take the Hamiltonian and you split it into a sum of terms acting on columns and a sum of term acting on rows. So it looks like this. And then each of the columns and rows itself, you do a 1D trotter decomposition like you would do in 1D TBD. So this thing gets split up as a set of two site gates. And we're going to apply it in the following order. First, I'm going to do all the columns, and then I'm going to do all the rows. So the algorithm is extremely easy to implement. It only takes like 100 lines. You start out with the orthogonality center down here, and you can think of this as being your wave function. And then you apply, you just cut out this thing, ignore all the rest of the tensors. So this thing here is that. And then you just apply standard 1D TBD. Like literally, you can call 1D TBD, where this is your wave function, and you use those gates. And then you turn it back into matrix product state form. So some of you who know about TBD for PEPs in general, there's environments and full updates and all this stuff. There's none of that here. You just call 1D TBD. And that's variationally optimal. So once you've applied TBD here, we're now ready to apply the Hamiltonian on the next column. So this is where the Moses move comes in. You use the Moses move to move the orthogonality center from here, one over to here. And then you're ready to apply TBD on this column. You do the 1D TBD, et cetera. So you do 1D TBD here, and then implicitly we're moving to the left, which is like 1D TBD in the other direction. Okay, so what do we do after we get all the columns? After we've done all the columns, the orthogonality center is here. then you just turn the diagram 90 degrees and you're ready to do the rows. And the rows moves this line up like that. And then you do the columns backwards. So as you go, you do column, row, and this red dot is just moving around like this. So it's super easy. The total cost is this here, d to the 6, a to the cube, d cubed, versus the tensor networks with full update, TBD has a d to the 12 term. This term, maybe someone has made this d to the 11, but if you fully invert the environment, I think that's d to the 12. So. I'm not actually sure whether this d to the 12 or that's more expensive, because the eta is many times larger than the d. But anyway, so it's faster. And in the final minute, I will show you the result for our favorite model in the universe, the transverse-slicing model. So we did square grids that are either 6x6, 8x8, or 10x10. This is about as large as we could go because we were using DMRG to get the energy, and the DMRG kind of craps out beyond this. And what I'm showing here is this chi equals 246 is actually d, sorry, so this is just the bond dimension. And this is the size of the trotter step. So if I look, for example, at L equals 6, for a small bond dimension, the error does this. Larger bond dimension, the error comes down, the error comes down. This is the error in the energy per unit volume. So as you'd expect, the error comes down almost exponentially with the size of the tensors. It has this weird feature that as a function of trotter step, the error goes down and then comes back up. That's actually perfectly understood. It's because it's a source of two errors. One is the trotter error, which goes as dt squared. The other is the fact that when you do the Moses move, you actually make a little bit of an error. And when you sum those two together, you would you predict a curve that looks like these dotted lines here, which is kind of what you see. But regardless, the error is coming down.
How far off the critical point are you?
Oh, this is pretty far off the critical. The critical point is at 3.06 or so.
Like, what's the correlation like?
The correlation, that's a good question, actually. I think it's probably like 6 or so. I'm not exactly. You think it's less? Yeah. I'm not actually sure because it wasn't super easy to compute a correlation length here because it's just a finite thing. Mm-hmm. No, I mean, 3.5 is not particularly stringent. We had other reasons for looking there. So this is extremely preliminary. Like, if I saw this, I wouldn't be convinced yet, because it's like, you want to see is how does this perform as you approach the critical point, et cetera.
Is L the linear size of the system?
L, yeah, it's L by L. So what we are mainly curious about at this point was, if this algorithm works, for a given bond dimension, the error per unit area should saturate as a function of L. Eventually, right? So like, if you look at the less accurate PEPs, you indeed see that the error here per site, this is the energy error per site, doesn't get worse. So that's good, because that's like behaving like you could actually take a thermodynamic limit. As it gets more accurate, you see there's a change in the error from 6 to 8, but then from 8 to 10, it doesn't change. And for the most accurate one, there's a change between all three. I think this kind of makes sense, actually, that the more accurate you get, the larger the length scale over which you will see a change in the energy error. It's pretty interesting, though. OK, so finally, last slide. DMRG squared is what we're implementing now. But it's the same kind of thing as TBD. Like, you're going to represent, you'll have the Hamiltonian here in MPO form. You call 1D DMRG on this wave function. Then you use the Moses move to move the wave function over, and then you call 1D DMRG again. So in here, it's a DMRG sweep. And then along the x-axis, it's also a DMRG sweep like this. So that's the sense in which the algorithm is DMRG squared. It's a bit trickier to implement, though. TBD is quite trivial, but for a DMRG, you need to keep track of all the Hamiltonian terms, and that's a bit of a pain. OK, so my time is up. So thank you, guys. Thank you.